In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome to the Tom Woods Show, episode 394. Today we're talking about deflation. This is the economic phenomenon that terrifies everybody, but it does not terrify our guest today, Philip Baggus, who is the author of a brand new book called, provocatively enough, In Defense of Deflation. Philip is a professor of economics at Universidad Rey Juan Carlos in Madrid. He is the author also of The Tragedy of the Euro and, along with David Howden, Deep Freeze, Iceland's Economic Collapse. We'll have links to all this material over at tomwoods.com/394, the show notes page for today. We'll also be linking to a previous episode we did a long, long time ago on the subject of deflation. But if you look at Philip's book, it is such an unbelievably systematic and careful step-by-step treatment of the subject. I don't think there's anything like it. I don't think anything like it has been done before. So I'm very pleased to welcome Philip to the show right now. Philip, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Good to hear you.
I'm very pleased to see this book. I've actually made a video about one of your other books, The Tragedy of the Euro. But here, now that I have my own show, I want to devote a show to this topic. That's a very provocative title you have, In Defense of Deflation. You are going up against the entire economic establishment, including some free market economists, right?
Yes, unfortunately, deflation has a very bad press.
I want to talk about why that is a little bit later, because you do speculate as to where all the hysteria against deflation is coming from. You begin by looking at different definitions of deflation, theories of deflation. These are all very important, but given our limited time today, I want to talk about primarily the causes of deflation, and I think of the four that you list, the first two might be the most important for a lay audience, or am I wrong?
Yes, probably. So
growth deflation and cash building deflation. Growth deflation, I think that is that's the easiest form for people to understand is benign.
Yes. And there even some of the mainstream economists, not the Keynesians, but some of the mainstream economists say, yes, growth deflation is good and can be allowed. No, growth deflation is simply when productivity increases and more goods and services are produced, and as a consequence, prices fall. No? So this is actually how our economies should look like, no? That when people save more, invest in capital goods, there's free competition, everyone gets richer by just the increase in productivity and prices fall, something that should be natural and something that was more or less natural in the 19th century. We had growth deflation in most of the Western world. So no problem at all. There was high economic growth and price deflation at the same time. Actually, one caused the other. No, economic growth caused the price deflation. But today we are not accustomed to this anymore because we live in a world of never-ending inflation.
But if we weren't, if we didn't have central banks engaging in monetary inflation, we would observe falling prices, not just in electronics, but we would observe them across the board the way we saw in the Western world in the 19th century and into the 20th century.
Yes. If we would be on a gold standard, it must not even be a full 100% gold standard. I mean, in the 19th century, it was not a 100% gold standard. But then the money supply, if gold would only be money, the stock of gold is increasing between 1% and 2% per year. And then if you have economic growth of 3% per year, then more or less we can say on the long run that prices fall 1%. per year, and people would get accustomed to it and anticipate that. It would make many things much easier.
All right, let's move into maybe a more controversial area, so-called cash-building deflation. This is when the demand for money increases. And just the layman hearing the term demand for money would think, well, the demand for money must be infinite because we all want an infinite amount of money. Let me just make sure for the layman, we're talking about, I mean, if I gave you $1 billion, you would not want to keep it all in dollars. You'd want to exchange it for cars and mansions and yachts and so on and so forth. That's what we're talking about, money demand. And when money demand increases and people are holding onto their money, this pushes prices down, and we're told in many cases that this is a bad thing, that there needs to be some policy to reverse the effects of this, or otherwise there will be all kinds of economic problems. First of all, what is the scenario? Explain to me why that is viewed as a bad thing, just that people want to hold more money. Why is that bad for the economy? Why can the economy not adjust to that according to the mainstream?
It's easier for the layman to, if you translate the demand, cash building like hoarding, no? And because when we hear the word hoarding, we think, oh, yeah, hoarding is bad. Why? Because people don't spend their money, so companies don't sell their products, so they have to fire their workers, and the workers demand even less, and we are in the downward spiral because of this cash building or hoarding. I mean, hoarding is already like a value judgment that this is something bad, no? So, yeah, this is the mainstream argument against cash building.
So what's the flaw in that thinking? This is a type of argument that, speaking of the layman, would, I think, resonate with the average person. Well, sure, because in fact, we're told that when people go out and spend a lot of money at Christmas time, this is a great thing for the economy. When people go out and spend their money on consumer goods, they are helping the economy. So that's why I think they're inclined to think that when people cease to spend so much money on consumer goods, this must be bad for the economy.
For one, we should ask, we could ask that later also, is why people start doing this. No, maybe they think there will be a natural catastrophe, and there's higher uncertainty, maybe there's a war, and therefore people spend less, hold their money together, which may make sense, not to be totally illiquid in such situations. No? But when the flaw in the argument is that when people want a higher real cash balance, because it's about higher real cash balance, they start to buy or sell faster their goods and services at lower prices, and then the prices adjust. The prices fall and people have a higher real cash balance. This does not necessarily affect production, because the cash building can stem from less investments and less consumer spending. You can spend your income on investing, buying factors of production, investing in production facilities, or from investing in consumer goods, buying consumer goods. So if you reduce the spending, it depends what you reduce more. If you reduce both in the same way, there's no effects on the structure of production. If, for example, people reduce relatively the consumer spending and more is invested in the capital goods sector, then there's economic growth, and it's actually good for the economy, because this means that entrepreneurs have more purchasing power and can use the goods that have not been consumed in order to stay in more complex, more productive production processes, and the economy can grow.
In the past, we've talked on this show about the problem of sticky prices, that if people are, as they sometimes say, hoarding money, that this is the prices should fall, but they don't fall as fast as they ought to, according to the critics. And as a result, they get stuck, and the stickiness of the prices leads to discoordination and unemployment and problems related to that. How do you answer the sticky price issue?
Yeah, as a company, you have your costs and your selling proceeds, and if your costs fall as fast as your revenues, your real profit situation remains the same. So the sticky price argument argues that the costs, for some reason, cannot fall as fast as the revenues. I mean, in principle, they could fall even faster, and during a price deflation, the profit situation may increase. If my costs fall much faster than my selling proceeds, my profits, real profits, increase. So what do they? They argue that the costs cannot fall as fast, and it may be that through government intervention, some prices cannot fall. For example, through minimum wage laws, wages are not allowed to fall, and this will cause unemployment. And this is, of course, true. This is, of course, true when prices are not allowed to fall, then there will be unemployed resources. In this case, however, the cause of the unemployment is not the price deflation, but exactly the opposite. It's the government that does not allow prices to fall.
In what way is government keeping prices from falling?
Yeah, just by minimum prices, like minimum wage laws, that a price, you're not allowed to settle for a price below a minimum. That is one reason, but there are also other reasons that through subsidies or through some subsidies, prices are not allowed to fall.
All right, let's go on ahead to the section where you talk about different myths concerning deflation. You have five of them. One of them is that deflation leads necessarily to mass unemployment. Now, that would be related to what we've already talked about, I suppose. But give the quick answer to that. First of all, why would it lead to mass unemployment? Because if people are – I understand the theory by which hoarding could lead to mass unemployment. The thinking there is that if I'm not spending on consumer goods, then – apparently, the economy is only consumer goods, so everybody will be unemployed. But the mere fact of falling prices in and of itself, why does that necessarily lead to mass unemployment, according to the critics?
Yeah, because of the sticky price argument. They argue that wages are sticky, you cannot adjust them. But yet there you have to think that the workers, when we settle for a working contract, we are also making an anticipation of how the purchasing power of the money that we will receive will develop. So we can anticipate a price deflation, so we can take this into account when we settle for our wages. We may be right, we may be wrong, and according to that, we may have profit or losses. But that's no problem, and we can always recontract the contract if we see that the company gets into problems. I mean, if you have agreed to keep the wage for 5 years for a certain amount, and then the company gets into troubles, then they can renegotiate the contract. That's no problem.
What is the myth that deflation leads to an arbitrary and unfair redistribution? What is that myth?
Yeah, it just says that in a price deflation, creditors are benefiting, because the real burden of the debt is increasing. It gets more difficult to pay back the nominal settled debts, and the creditor gets the money back in the ever higher purchasing power.
Okay, so let me just make sure everybody's following here. If I have borrowed money, I borrowed $100, and now because of falling prices, that $100 is now really worth $200 in terms of the goods I could get. So when I go to repay the $100, I'm in effect repaying $200. So the burden on me has grown, And this is why we often hear complaints that debtors suffer very much under deflation and creditors do very well. And this is a reason, prima facie reason, to be opposed to deflation.
Exactly. The question is, of course, what caused the prices to fall? Was it voluntary interaction of people? Was it a price deflation or a cash building deflation? Or was it the fiat deflation we haven't talked about, where the government, for example, just confiscates, for example, money? Well, then I would say it would be unjust, but the unjust thing is the confiscation. if it's just the result of voluntary interaction in the marketplace, one party of the contract, of the debt contract, anticipated better the evolution of future prices than the other. And it's just the outcome of free interaction.
But if creditors are benefited in deflation in general, why is it that the whole financial sector is so deathly afraid of deflation? Like, banks don't want deflation, contrary to popular belief. They don't want wouldn't it be because, first of all, people can't pay their debts in that situation? They don't want a lot of defaults.
Right. You gave the answer. They are afraid, of course, of such a deflationary spiral that could lead to mass defaults. And then, in our financial system today, just a spark of uncertainty can lead to huge problems, and like dominoes, it all collapsing. So they need an environment where there's huge confidence in the money, in the monetary system, and deflation and defaults can end it. And of course, they are against deflation because they want inflation, because they profit from inflation, because they are inflating. They produce the new money that is used to combat deflation. So they are interested in combating deflation by producing more money, what they do themselves, what is their most profitable business.
I want to skip one of your sections temporarily. One of the things you do here is you give two historical examples of deflation. I'll focus, given that we have primarily an American audience, on the American growth deflation from 1865 to 1896, because the very fact that we have these clear historical examples should at least, give people a sense that there must be something to what you're saying, because the standard account would hold that these examples can't really exist or can't occur. And yet here they are actually occurring. There are many American historians who, for a long time, until recently anyway, thought that the period from certainly the 1870s to the 1890s was a terrible one for the American economy. But you've shown that the truth is something like the opposite.
Exactly. It was a period of high economic growth causing price deflation. Of course, there were already boom and busts because there was a fractional reserve banking system. But living standards were increasing very, very fast, very consistently. And the people who were against price deflation were, of course, debtors, people who were highly indebted and had committed malinvestments. They wanted to be bailed out of this situation by more inflation. So they wanted, for example, they thought that the silver supply would increase faster than the gold supply. So they wanted to switch to a silver standard, or they wanted to issue unbacked greenbacks to counter this situation. And around these people interested in inflation, theories developed arguing that deflation was the worst thing imaginable, while the reality was exactly the opposite. Living standards were constantly rising, productivity was increasing, there was high economic growth.
I want to let listeners know that we covered deflation on this show quite a while ago. I don't remember exactly when. And that episode will have a lot of the points that we don't have time to get into in this episode. So it should think of should be thought of as a supplement to this one. So tomwoods.com/394 is where we've got all the links to you and your work and this book and your other books, and also to the previous episode in which we talked about this. Now, I'm looking here at the different theories you have for why there is this fanatical, I mean, it really is fanatical, this opposition to falling prices and the dire warnings that we hear from all sectors. And you've got a bunch of different possible reasons for the hysteria. The one that I've talked about a little bit is the third one you have here, deflationary redistribution and its opposition. There are influential institutions that get hurt by deflation, whether it's the government or the financial sector in one way or another, that gets hurt. And since they get hurt disproportionately, and they happen to have the ear of the media, we hear them constantly. But inflation, which hurts so many ordinary people, we hear very, very muted criticisms of inflation. So can you say something about this?
Yes, this is exactly right what you say. In inflation, the common guy, so to speak, suffers. And not so much because the burden is spread over many shoulders, over everyone. Every money user is suffering a little bit, while in a deflation, the losses may be more concentrated on the debtors that have usually high debts. And the default, of course, of a company is much more visible and noticeable than the loss in purchasing power of many, many people. And of course, these debtors that are highly leveraged, that took advantage of our monetary system by indebting themselves, they have much more power than the typical Joe that loses in purchasing power. So this is the financial industry, that are banks. The biggest debt, of course, in our economy is the government, which is always against deflation, always in favor of inflating their debts away, and also highly leveraged companies. No? And they are, of course, very strong lobbying groups. And they, of course, make huge advertisements in the media, and it's not very surprising that there's such a deflation phobia all around us, when banks, the Federal Reserve, the economists, the government, the public university professors, they all have an interest, indirectly at least, to be against deflation.
Another of these theoretical causes for why people oppose falling prices is the relationship that people believe exists between deflation and recession. And there may indeed be a relationship between deflation and recession, but it's not the relationship most people believe exists. Can you explain this?
Yes, historically, some price deflations occurred during recessions, most noticeably the Great Depression. And during the Great Depression, there was price deflation. But one thing is correlation, and another thing is the causation. The Great Depression was caused by the huge inflation, by the huge credit expansion during the 1920s. And then the recession, of course, there was bank credit deflation and prices came back, fell down. But this was not the cause of the recession, but just the consequences of the artificial boom that occurred before. And the falling prices actually were beneficial. They liquidated some malinvestments faster. They spurred savings. And they led to higher savings. And in a recession, we need higher savings. And the recession, we have to remember, is the period of getting better. The economy gets better. It gets healthier again. Before, there was a distortion, and then during the recession, that is the good period when everything gets sorted out again, gets aligned with consumer preferences again. So people naturally think, okay, there was the Great Depression and prices fell, so falling prices must be bad, but not. It's the other way around. Falling prices can help to accelerate the recuperation.
Because of the whole problem initially began with an inflationary episode. And then what so many of the critics want to look at, they want to, instead of looking at the whole story, they want one snapshot of the economy. And in this snapshot, they, or a couple of snapshots, they see prices falling, but they don't look at the snapshots or the video, let's say, of the economy over the previous 3 years and what had been happening. They just look at the very end. In fact, Paul Krugman even said in the most recent financial crisis that he's sick and tired of people who are spending their time trying to figure out how we got into this mess when the real issue is how we get out of it. But how can you separate the two things?
Yeah, he's a clown.
Yeah, that is indeed right. Well, listen, before you and I started talking on the air here, so to speak, I told you that I had never seen such a systematic economic and historical discussion of the subject of deflation before, and I asked if you were familiar with any comparable book, and you said no, that's the reason you wrote this one, which makes perfect sense. So I will encourage people to check it out. Of course, if you are a college student and you can check it out at your university library, that would be easiest, because I think we owe it to the listeners to tell them that, unlike your other books, this one is unfortunately priced for academic libraries, if we may put it that way.
That's totally correct. Unfortunately, I must say. Unfortunately,
that is true. But perhaps in the future there'll be a paperback or an electronic edition or something. But certainly they should read your work on deflation, because it is so iconoclastic and so important, and to my mind, very persuasive. I appreciate your time today. The show notes page linking to all this will be tomwoods.com/394, and I hope we'll be able to talk to you again in the future. Thanks, Philip.
You're very welcome, Tom.
And that is the show for today. Make sure and check out tomwoods.com/394 for more information. Of course, check out libertyclassroom.com, which is where you can learn real economics, the kind they didn't teach you in school, but the kind we all should have learned, plus history and other fun subjects taught by professors you can trust. libertyclassroom.com, coupon code SHOW in all caps gets you 30% off. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.